I'm going to try to keep it short and very descriptive, as many of you actually work on NGN and high energy disks, so I hope that won't be too boring. I'm going to talk about planet disk interactions, but I'll be focusing on the effect of magnetic fields on planet migration, as that's what I've been working on recently. But I'm going to begin with a general description. So I think you've had a talk already by Phil Armitage on migration, so I don't know how much he talked about the different processes, but if you feel like you've already heard what I'm going to talk about, you just let me know and I'll go faster. So first of all, the reason why migration is important is here. As of today, we have something like, as of yesterday, we had 170 planets now. And we don't have more planetary systems than planets, so there was something wrong here. I think that's been a you have to solve these numbers here. So we have something like 160 planets and 130 planetary systems. So, you know, every day, kind of every day, there is an announcement. So this is not an exhaustive plot. You don't have all the planets here, but mainly what the point I want to make here is that this is the separation between the central star and the planet that has been depicted around those stars. And here you have the semi-major axis. 1AU is here. So the point I want to make here is that you have a whole distribution of separation, and some of the planets that have been detected orbit very, very close to the central star. So you can see that more clearly on this plot here. You have the planet mass here versus the semi-major axis. So this is one Jupiter mass, and this is 5 astronomical units. So you would expect to find Jupiter here. And you can see that the characteristic of the planets that have been observed are very different from the characteristic of Jupiter. So of course we are biased, in the sense that we are biased toward heavy objects close to the apparent stars, given that they've been detected using radial velocity measurements. So stars have been surveyed for about 10 years. So you are limited to periods of about 10 years, which gives you a limit at about 4AU. So the fact that you have nothing beyond here doesn't mean that there aren't planets further away, of course. It's just that we haven't had time to detect them yet. So you have the lightest planet is 8 Earth masses. I mean, if that one is confirmed, I heard that there may be questions about that very light planet. But basically, it goes from 8 Earth masses up to 13 Jupiter masses, or so if that's the limit for planets. And you can see that some of them are incredibly close. This is 0.1 astronomical unit. So what do we need migration for? Well, we need migration to explain these planets, because they are very, these are giant planets. So they need lots of material to form. And according to the core accretion scenario, you form planets first by assembling a solid core, the mass of which is between 5 and 13 Jupiter Earth masses in our own solar system. And then you have to accrete a heavy envelope of gas around these cores. If you want to form these cores, you need rocky material. You need ices if the core is really big. And you can't find these materials in a solid form very near the star. It's just too hot. And the condensation temperature is lower than the temperatures that you have at 0.1 or 0.5 astronomical unit from the star. So you know that you can't have build up these cores that close to the star. So either you have formed the planet further away and you have migrated it all the way to the star, or you have formed the cores further away and then, you know, you may have accreted the envelope as you were already close to the star. But in any case, some kind of migration at some point is needed there to explain why these planets have ended up so close to the star. So I think there is a consensus on that. The other reason why you need migration is in the different planetary systems that have been detected, some of the planets are in resonances, in mid-motion resonances. And we talked a little bit about that yesterday in the discussion we had about the satellites of Jupiter. Planets can't end up in resonance by chance. So if they are found in resonances, it's probably because you've had some migration and they've got captured into these resonances. So I would say these are the two main reasons why you need migration to explain the systems that have been observed. So Well, let's talk about something else than migration. How can you actually, are there other means, other ways of getting this planet so close to the star? So one process that you could look at is the interaction between two massive planets. If these planets interact with each other, then you know the orbits may cross. And then you may eject one planet and find the other planet taking all the binding energy and going very close to the central star. So that certainly happens. If you take a system of planets in orbit around the star and you let them interact with each other, you do get that kind of process. The problem is that the number of planets you end up with very close to the star is not that large. Here you have something like 20% of the planets are hot Jupiter, they're very close to the star. And you don't get this kind of number if you just rely on this kind of process. So this kind of process certainly works, but it can't explain all the population of hot Jupiter.
Sorry, is that a statement that it's 20% of the observed extrasolar
planets? Right.
20% of all the G-type stars?
No, no, of all the observed systems. I mean,
the surveyed systems.
20% of the systems in which you have found a planet.
Okay, but then you've got all the observational biases.
Sure, but nonetheless, these planets exist. So even if you take something like 180 systems, and run some kind of n-body simulations.
And 10% of the observed stars have detected planets.
Well, at most. It's more like 7 or, depending on who you talk
to.
10. Yeah, 5 to 10. But what I mean is that, yeah, but if you take 180 systems and run an n-body code for each of these 180 systems, you won't end up with 20% of the Jupiter on closed orbit. The probability for that to happen is much lower, okay? So that can't explain all the systems. Another process which has been put forward, I mean, it's actually a process that's been known for a long time because it's been used to explain why you have resonances between the objects of the asteroid belt and Jupiter in our own solar system. It's what we call the migration instability. So I'm sorry that the plot is really very dim here. So, but basically the way it works is the following. If you have a planet which is on a circular orbit here around a star. Inside the orbit of that planet, you have plenty of planetesimals left, you know, when the planet has formed. So you are going to have interactions, gravitational interactions between this planet and the planetesimals. And what you find is that these interactions, which are actually resonant, end up in planetesimals leaving the inner disk and being ejected in the outer disk. You have more planetesimals being ejected in the outer disk than planetesimals from the outer disk coming inside. So the disk is getting energy. So the planet here is losing energy and is actually migrating inward. So that's a way of migrating a planet inward. The problem is that if you want to take a planet at 5 AU and move it all the way to the central star, and if you want to take a Jupiter mass planet at 5 AU and move it all the way to the star, you need the mass here of planetesimals, which is comparable to the mass of the planet itself. Because you need to dump all your angular momentum to material which is moving more or less at the same velocity as you, because the interaction is limited to neighbors here. So it means you need something like 10 to the minus 3 solar mass of planetesimals within 5 AU. And if you have 100 times more gas, then you need a disk of gas which is about 10% of the mass of the central object. And such a disk is just too massive. I mean, it would be gravitationally unstable, and it's not really the kind of things which are observed. So this mechanism works if you want to move a planet on a small scale, like for instance Jupiter, you know, to catch asteroids in resonances. But it's not going to explain why planets have moved all the way from you know, beyond the snow line to the central star. So the processes that people have focused on is actually, it's the same kind of interactions, except that instead of interacting with planetesimals, you interact with the gas. You don't have much planetesimals, but you have lots of gas to interact with. So it's easier to dump your angular momentum to the gas. So how does it work? I mean, how does migration work? It's just a matter of exchanging angular momentum between the different components of your disk. So it works like in the Earth-Moon system, for instance. I've been told that this arrow should be in the other direction, but I couldn't change it, so. So basically what happens in the Earth-Moon system is that the Earth spins around itself faster than the Moon on its orbit. So you have a transfer of angular momentum from the Earth to from the spin motion of the Earth to the orbital motion of the Moon. And as a result, the Moon is drifting away because it's picking up angular momentum, and the Earth is slowing down. Now, if you take a Keplerian disk, you put a planet here, then the material which is inside the orbit is moving faster than the planet, and the planet itself is moving faster than the material which is outside the orbit. So as a result, you have a transfer of angular momentum from the inner parts to the planet and from the planet to the outer part. Now, if the planet picks up angular momentum from these guys here, it's going to be pushed outward. And the material here is going to be pushed inward because it's going to lose angular momentum. If the planet is giving angular momentum to the outer part, it's going to be pushed inward. And the outer parts are going to be pushed outward. So the result is that the outer parts push the planet inward, and the inner parts push the planet outward. Now, if these effects balance each other, you get nothing. But it turns out that the outer disk has actually more effect on the planet than the inner disk, for a reason that I'll come back to later. So you end up having a planet which moves inward. So these things have been known for a long time. I mean, Goldreich and Tremmen did all these calculations in the late 70s, and Bill Wall had predicted migration already in 86. But that's been applied, of course, to planets only when Pegasi 51 was discovered. So if you have, so as I said, the difference between the torque which is exerted by the outer disk is actually larger than the torque which is exerted by the inner disk, so the planet tends to move inward. Now, if the planet has a very low mass, if it has a mass which is much smaller than the gas in its neighborhood, it's going to dump all its angular momentum to the neighboring gas. But the gas is not going to see the difference. It's like if you take the angular momentum of an ant and put it in an elephant, the elephant won't see the difference. So the planet is going to lose angular momentum, it's going to move through the gas, but the gas won't really see the difference. So you are going to have migration with respect to the disk. The disk won't see anything, it's a linear regime. And the time scale on which the planet is going to migrate can be calculated, and it turns out to be rather short. It's certainly shorter than the planetary formation time scale for core, and it's shorter than the disk lifetime. So this is the Earth mass, this is the planet mass. So if, for instance, you have a planet which is one Earth mass at 1 AU in a disk in which H over R is 10 to the minus 1 and the surface density of about 10 to the 3 gram per square centimeter, you get something which is on the order of 10 to the 5 years.
Well, shouldn't the mass of the disk be in that expression?
You have the surface density here, which... That's the disk surface density. But here you have assumed again that the mass of the disk is larger than the mass of the planet, so you can do a linear analysis. Okay, so everything, what you get actually, if you do numerical simulations, what you see is what looks like that. It looks like a boat, you know, going through water. So you have these waves. Actually, if you had a differential rotation here, this wave here would come on the other side, and you would get exactly what you have in a disk. And the boat goes through, and then, you know, the sea just comes back to a normal. That's exactly what you see in numerical simulations as well. So the planet is remigrating through the gas. So that's what we call type 1 migration. So what happens now if you increase the planet mass? What you have here, this is the surface density of the disk. So one means it's unperturbed. And this is the position of the planet here. So the planet is initially here. It's moving inward. So if you have a very low mass planet, it doesn't have much effect on the disk. But as the mass of the planet increases, you can imagine what happens. I mean, the planet is moving through the gas. So as its mass increases, it's pushing the material ahead of its orbit. So you end up having here an increase, a pileup of mass ahead of the orbit. And you have here a decrease of density behind the orbit. So the material is being pushed ahead of the orbit. So at some point, this material here, this is from the disk, is going to exert a feedback torque on the planet, and the planet is going to have to stop. It won't be able to move with respect to the gas anymore. So what will happen is that the planet is just going to stop. It won't be able to migrate. But you will still have angular momentum being transported from the disk to the planet and from the planet to the disk. So what happened here is that the planet has stopped, but because you still have this angular momentum transport, the inner part is being pushed in and the outer parts are being pushed out. So you get the gap on both sides of the planet's orbit. So you can imagine now you have your planet which is in this gap. There isn't anybody around. But the whole disk now may be evolving viscously, if I may say, towards the central star by some, you know, you may have some turbulent process in the disk which is such that the whole disk is evolving towards the central star. Then the planet is locked into this transport. The outer edge of the gap tends to push the planet in, and the inner edge is moving in because of viscous evolution. So the whole thing now is migrating towards the star, but the planet is moving with the gas here. The migration is not with respect to the gas, but is with the gas. And the time scale for the migration here is just a viscous time scale. So again, that may be, you know, rather fast, depending on the alpha parameter you have. That's going to be on the order of 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 years at 5 AU, which again is very short compared to the lifetime of those disks. So the way you can actually look at this problem here is rather simple. You can, if you have a planet which is sitting there, so R is increasing here, this is the star. You sit on the planet, you see the particles from the outer disk, for instance, coming in that direction. So when they come close to you, they pick up angular momentum because they are moving slower than the planet. So after the interaction, they have too much angular momentum for the initial orbit. So they tend to be pushed to an orbit which is further away from the star. But by doing that, they are going to meet some particles that haven't been deflected that much. And you are going to have some shocks here. So all these particles here are moving away. In the inner part, you get the opposite. So the particles are moving closer to the star. It's down here and it's up here. And then you end up with a region here where you have nothing except those particles which are on a horseshoe orbit. And they may diffuse away as well if you have some kind of viscosity in there. So that's what we call type 2 migration. For that to work, you need to have a rather massive planet. And basically, if you calculate the condition for this gap opening, you find something for standard nebula, you need something like a Jupiter mass. Once you get a Jupiter mass, you begin to open up a gap. So there's been lots of simulations of these processes. And what you have plotted here as a 3D calculation of the migration rate by Tanaka et al. And here you have the 2D calculation. So what you should look at are this curve here for the high mass planet, because here, whether it's 2D or 3D, you get the same answer. But for low mass planet, when you do the linear analysis, you should really consider a 3D model. And these points here come from numerical simulations. And you see that they agree pretty well with analytical predictions. So this is, for instance, what you... I think this is at, it's probably at 5 AU, because world calculation was done for 5 AU. I'm not sure, I tried, I actually wondered yesterday. I think this is 5 AU. So you can see that for an Earth mass planet at 5 AU, you would get, you know, two million years for the migration. Well, it depends, because it's certainly a prime for cores, like, you know, the core of Jupiter would be something like 10 to, it would be 10 Earth masses, so the migration time scale would be only a few hundred thousand years. But for an Earth mass at 1 AU, it would actually be shorter, because when you get closer to the star, it goes faster. So this is an upper limit if this is 5 AU. So it's something like a million years. But this is supposed to live longer than a million years. So this is what you get if you do some numerical simulations. This is a simulation by Richard Nelson, where you put a planet in a hydro disk and let it evolve. So you see clearly here this gap which has opened. These are the density waves that are excited by the planet and that moves away from the orbit. And you see that you have these wakes here. And you can see that the torque that's exerted by these wakes are such that the planet is migrating inward.
Is
SPH? No, this is grid based.
So just go back to the earlier plot. Of the migration time scales. Are those converged calculations in the sense that there are no longer significant uncertainties associated with the region immediately around?
No, there is. I mean, I've actually shown these numbers because I agree with the analytical calculations. Willy Klein had done some calculations as well where it didn't really agree as well with the analytical calculations. But there's been some problems with the way the material which is within the Roche lobe, for instance, has been treated in these calculations, and it hasn't converged, and there's still lots of arguments about that.
These are excluding, they're estimated toward by excluding the region.
Which is probably fine. You can actually make an analytical argument to show that torque doesn't come from matter which is within the Roche lobe. So that's why, you know, I don't want to dwell too much on that, but the lattice calculation that seem to indicate that you get a much bigger contribution from the matter within the Roche lobe than what was previously thought is a bit dubious. You want to have something? Sorry. So I just show you that for, you know, because everybody has seen this picture and it's very nice. So that's by Jeff Bryden. So this is exactly the same kind of stuff as I was showing just before. Here you just have, he's added a 3D effect and, you know, he's put these nice stars in the background. But basically that's what you get if you run simulations of a planet interacting with a disk. So there's been some new results recently in 2003 about intermediate regime. So I've talked about what happens when the planet has very low mass, and I've talked about what happens if the planet has a high mass. But what happens in the intermediate regime is a bit more tricky. So it seems like you get what's been called a Hunaway, a type 3 or Hunaway migration in the regime where you have intermediate mass, like for instance for Saturn mass planet. So what you see here are the orbits of the particles in the region which correlates with the planet. So the planet is here. This is the distance to the star. The star is somewhere here. The planet is there. And this is the azimuth. So in reality, the thing is closing on itself. So this part, the planet is here and there. And these particles here are describing this horseshoe orbit in the correlating region. So if you look at closely what happens, you have these particles which are on this horseshoe orbit, which are liberating elements. They migrate with the planet. They're trapped. They migrate with the planet, which means that they lose angular momentum as the planet is migrating inward. So they do exert a positive torque on the planet as a feedback. Now, as the planet is moving in, there are elements, 3D elements, that cross the orbit of the planet and go from the inside the orbit outside to the exterior of the orbit. So these 3D elements that cross the horseshoe region, they do gain angular momentum as the planet is moving in.
So these migrating 3D elements, these are trapped?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this is all collisions?
Yeah, I mean, they could diffuse away in principle if you had some process. It's probably slower than the time scale that are relevant here. It's been seen to diffuse away in numerical simulations, but very slowly. So these 3D elements that cross the horseshoe region, they gain angular momentum, so as a feedback, they exert negative torque on the planet. Now, if you have a gap which is depleted, so if you are in the intermediate regime where you begin to clear up a gap, then these guys are going to be more important than those. So you'll get the net torque on the planet will be negative, and you'll get a torque which is going to be bigger if the planet is moving faster, because then you'll have more elements crossing the orbit of the planet. So you get a runaway process here. What's interesting is that if the planet for some reason moves outward, the torque that you are going to get here, all the reasoning I've made here was assuming that the planet was moving inward. But you can imagine that the planet is moving outward and you have to reverse all the torques here. So if the planet moves outward, you get a feedback which enhances the outward migration rate. So this is really a runaway process, and that's been, there's been simulations of these things, and it's been seen to do exactly what it's expected. There has been a recent paper where people claim it's not working that way, but again, there are questions about how they treat the matter here, which is in the low horseshoe of the planet.
Well, if I could just comment, the recent work by Gennaro Grangelo,
yeah, but I mean the conclusions they draw from the paper, for instance, is not using some of the plots that they have in their paper that have been run with a very high resolution. I mean, it's kind of a mess. I mean, I don't want to give any names, but it's kind of a mess. I mean, So the conclusions they make do depend on which figures they look at in their paper. And secondly, it's not clear that what they've done is correct at all. I mean, the material that they're having for you to calculate the torque is really, I mean, some of it is bound to the planet. So I wouldn't take that as a final argument.
No, but I think it's fair to say that the earlier numerical simulations were under-resolved.
Right, but you can make actually some analytical argument showing that this material shouldn't have any effect on the torque. I mean, I'll show you that later if you're interested. So anyway, what all these things suggest is that migration is very efficient and that you do lose planets before you can even form them. Or even if you manage to form them, you know, the disks still exist once the planets are formed, and you may lose some of these planets onto the central star. So some people have said, well, maybe that's just what happens. I mean, you get these planets, they fall onto the star, and you know, they are just, and then you form more until migration is less efficient for whatever reason, and then you can keep one or more planets around the star. So people have looked at whether the stars around which you have planets are actually more meta-rich than the others. And it is a case that if you look at the stars which have no planets and the stars around which you have found planets, there is a clear difference in the metallicity content of these objects. So the stars which harbor planets are more meta-rich, and the difference is significant. So it's been interpreted at first by some people by saying, you know, you've really dumped some metal-rich planet onto the stars, and that's what you are seeing here. So the observers think it's not the explanation. They think it's actually primordial. You have a primordial explanation. You actually tend to form planets in a more metal-rich environment, which really makes sense, I mean, since you need to assemble a core to begin with. So that's because you don't find the difference in all the elements, for instance. So they tend to think that this just indicates that you need more metal to form planets.
Abundance change. I mean, if you had a tenth of solar mass in iron and you brought it in, you're still in the abundance by several tenths than you are.
Is that in solar units or in absolute units?
I think this is, yeah. Yeah, this is the sun. It's respective to the sun. Yeah, there's this argument. There is also the argument that you don't actually find this difference in metallicity for all the elements, I think. So. Yeah, but you can always take a very thin convective zone to. yeah. But anyway, it's still an interesting question to ask, you know, how do we actually stop migration? How can you retain some of the cores on their orbit? And how can you form a Jupiter planet and prevent it from migrating to the central star? So the talk is not going to be about all the arguments that have been put forward. I'm just going to concentrate on what the magnetic field could do for you. And if all this work has been done in a disk which has no magnetic field. Now, if you put a magnetic field in this disk, how is the picture modified? So that's what I'm going to concentrate on right now. So before going there, I'd like to show you with a little bit more details exactly how this migration process works. If you calculate the torque which is exerted by the planet on the disk, you basically just have to compute an integral of that form. So rho prime here is the perturbed density in the disk, and this is a potential of the planet. So the torque is actually exerted on the perturbation itself. And the disk is axisymmetric, so the torque on the background disk is zero. So what you can see immediately here is that if the perturbation varies on a scale which is very small compared to the scale on which the potential or the tidal force varies, then you'll get almost nothing from this integral because you are going to have to integrate radially. And if you have something which has a very small wavelength, it's not going to give you anything. So the contribution to this torque comes from the locations where the perturbation has a long scale. So it's mainly the turning points of the perturbation or the resonances. So you get mainly, you can isolate three places where this integral is going to be significant. These are the Lindblad resonances, where the frequency of the perturbation matches the epicyclic frequency of the fluid elements. And you have the co-rotation, where the frequency of the perturbation matches that the angular frequency of the elements. So the torque which is exerted in the vicinity of the Lindblad resonances is actually advected through the disk. So the waves transport angular momentum as a result of the torque that's exerted by the planet. And they transport this angular momentum to the boundary of the disk, or they may transfer it to the disk if they're actually damped at some point. The torque which is exerted at co-rotation is a bit different. It's transmitted to the disk at the location where the co-rotation is. It's like Lando damping in a plasma. And if you send a wave, an electromagnetic wave in a plasma, you'll get, if the phase velocity of the wave is very different from that of the electrons, then the electrons are going to be accelerated or decelerated randomly. So you get no net effect. Now, if you have a phase velocity which matches that of the electrons are going to surf the wave. So they'll be constantly accelerated or decelerated. And if you have a Maxwellian velocity, then you'll have more electrons going a little bit slower than the wave. So they're going to actually feel a net acceleration from the wave, and the wave is going to be damped. And it's exactly what happens here. The particles of the fluid are just surfing the tidal wave that co-rotates with the planet. So you get a net transfer of angular momentum from the planet to the fluid at that location. Yes, actually here it's not, whether you actually gain or lose angular momentum depends on the gradient of velocity actually in your disk. Not like for a plasma where it's always damping of the wave. Here it's not necessarily the case. So just to illustrate a little bit more, you have the star here, you have the planet here, this is the orbit of the planet, and this is the radial direction. Then, on both parts of the planet, you have these Lindblad resonances, where the frequency of the wave matches that of the epicyclic frequency of the fluid. What you find is that, as a result of the perturbation from the planet, you excite density waves that propagate outside the Lindblad resonances. And the planet exerts a torque on this wave, and that's going to enable the exchange of angular momentum between the planet, the orbital motion of the planet and the disk. So you can see in this picture, you can begin to see that what's important here really, where you can have resonances between the free oscillations of the disk and the perturbation that's induced by the planet. Now, if you put a magnetic field in your disk, you are going to have more degrees of freedom. So you are going to be able to have more resonances in your disk where you are going to be able to apply your torque. So in principle, that should enable you to change the picture of migration that you've got in a hydro disk. So if you actually calculate the angular momentum flux in your disk, you see, I'm sorry, it's very dim, but this is the angular momentum flux. The planet is here. So here you are inside the disk, so you have something which is more or less constant here. The perturbation is very weak. And then you have a big change here in the angular momentum flux at the location of the inner Lindblad resonance. You have a discontinuity at the location of the co-rotation resonance, which really indicates that you transfer angular momentum into this there. And here you have a big change again at the outer Lindblad resonance, and then it's more or less constant again. So from this plot, you can read directly the torque that's exerted on the planet. The difference between the outer value here and the inner value here gives you the torque exerted at the Lindblad resonances, which is carried away by the waves. And the discontinuity here gives you the torque at the co-rotation resonance. So here you can read off the total torque and see how the planet is going to move and calculate the timescale for migration.
Is the angular momentum flux corresponding to the magnetic field?
No. Here that's still for the hydro part.
Awesome.
Yeah. That was just really straight. So now if you put a magnetic field, so I come back to these pictures where you had the inner Lindblad resonance, the outer Lindblad resonance, and the density wave. If you had a magnetic field, so in the calculations I've done, I've just put a toroidal magnetic field so that keeps it 2D and tractable, but, you know. So now if you have a magnetic field, you more or less have the same resonances here, Lindblad resonances. They are more or less at the same location. And the waves that propagate away from these resonances are now called magnetosonic waves, but basically it's the same thing as what you had without a magnetic field. What's new here is that you get two other resonances which are inside the Lindblad resonances. And at the location of these resonances, the frequency of the perturbation matches the frequency of a slow energy wave which is propagating more or less along the field line. You've got another degree of freedom here, which gives you more resonances. And
it seems to me that the resonance of the magnetic field of a given wavelength depends on the magnetosonic velocity, right? It depends on the strength of the field.
It does, but
so why is it always within the Lindbergh resonance?
It's always within the Lindbergh resonances, but it moves from here to there depending on the, if you have a very weak magnetic field, these two resonances merge here to give you the co-rotation resonance. As the field goes to zero, this gets closer and closer and merge into the co-rotation resonance for zero magnetic field.
Very strong.
But then these move toward the Lindbergh resonances as a limit. Yeah. Yeah, that's what the limit is.
It looks like but Carolyn, is it sensible to assume that the field is coupled? And if it is sensible to assume that the field is coupled to the fluid, isn't the...
Unstable. Okay, so I'm going to come back to that. Of course, that's Ferrari. So, well, first of all, when I began that work, I didn't know that it would be the slow mode that would be important. And of course, at the slow mode, that's destabilized by the MRI. So the question, the next question is, well, okay, but if I have a field which is weak here, this mode is going to be destabilized. So just to answer this question, and I'll come back to that later, it's actually the values of... M, which are important here, are low, are very low values. The values of M, which are destabilized by the MRI, are high values. So it may be that even if you have the instability going on, you may still have some effect coming from these resonances. But it's not clear, I agree with you.
So you want to average over the turbulent cells and provide, have some mean, slow magnetosonic
wave. Basically, yeah.
Superposed on the turbulent.
Yeah. But it may not work, but nonetheless, what that could tell you is that in the disk inner part, for instance, if you have a stellar field that's connected to the disk, you could enter a region where the magnetic field is strong, so which wouldn't be MRI unstable, and where this process would work. But, I mean, this is just, I don't know, okay? What I'm telling you is what I know exactly, what happens if you put a strong field. So now, because it's a slow mode, indeed, it may not be relevant, unless the field is very strong.
What is the field geometry?
This is toroidal here. It's just because analytically it was more tractable, I could keep it 2D and do the calculations. But, you know, you could make arguments with a...
No, I'm really confused. So this is a strong magnetic field?
No, this is, in principle, this is for any strength.
Yeah.
What's relevant here is actually not the strength of the magnetic field, it's the strength of the beta parameter, as always.
Right, so is beta greater or less than infinity? In other words, what's the propagation speed for the slow mode?
But it doesn't matter, it can be whatever you want here. What I'm describing is very general.
Well, okay, but then I'm wondering, could we do this with just acoustic waves and hydro?
No.
Okay.
No, because if you have only acoustic waves with hydro, you don't have these resonances.
Okay.
You're going to see why they're important in my argument.
Okay.
So what happens if you okay.
But just to clarify, because there is a point here which may be confusing, and that is, if field is sufficiently large, what you call the slow mode completely changes character. Then the slow mode becomes an acoustic mode.
Yeah, so you really mean an alphanic mode.
So I think what she means is beta is still bigger than 1, but not much bigger than 1. So
it can be 100. It can be 100. It's fine. It still works.
Yeah, but it can't be 0.1.
No. Okay. No.
So the slow mode is alphanic.
No. It can be 0.2. It can be 0.1.
It can be much less than 1.
If it's much less than 1, then what you're calling the slow mode is actually an acoustic mode. You want it to have an alphanic character, I think, in this calculation. You're identifying it as the slow mode. It has to be the slow part.
Yeah, okay. I call it a...
Okay.
I call it a slow mode because I've been interested mainly in beta larger than 1, but you can actually... it works also for beta 0.1.
But it may not be the slow mode.
Okay, you call it something else, but it's still the same physics. If you have beta is 0.1,
right.
You still have these resonances. Yeah. Yeah, you still have these resonances inside.
It's the magnetic mode. It's the magnetic.
Okay, and the reason why it's important to keep in mind that's a slow mode for beta larger than 1 is that may be destabilized if you have in a disk. Yeah. So anyway, if you have no magnetic field, the only regions where you have waves propagating is outside these Lindbergh resonances. Now, if you have a magnetic field, you actually propagate waves around. These resonances here in a very restricted region, but nonetheless they do propagate around. They propagate mainly along the field lines, but they also propagate within some restricted region here. And you do get a torque onto this wave. So now, if you have a magnetic field which strength is large enough, you are going to have this torque is going to dominate the torque that you exert at the Lindblad resonances just because the resonances are closer. So you actually don't need that a big field, because if the field gets smaller, these things move closer to the star. So you still have an effect which is important. So even for large values of beta, you still have, for beta 100, you still have an effect from these resonances that dominate the Lindblad torque. So now, it seems suspicious.
Well, I still think you're doing linear theory around a state that doesn't exist.
No, but that's okay. It may not be. But again, when I began that, I didn't know that would be the slow mode. So, but I don't completely agree with you. I mean, you can think of situations where, you know, again, if you have a strong field, that's if you have beta is one, for instance, in the inner part of it, it may be the only way that would work. But you can't say you can't rule it out really. But anyway, I mean, I'd like to finish just describing that, and then we can ask the questions whether it's relevant or not. So the interesting thing here is that, you know, the Lindblad resonances you can't play with. The position of the Lindblad resonances is completely determined in a Keplerian disk just by the geometry of the Keplerian flow. Here, if you have a magnetic field which varies with radius, you can make the inner resonance more important than the outer resonance, for instance. And then this torque here is going to dominate, and that's going to push the planet outward. So now if you give your field a gradient in the right direction, you are going to reverse migration. So you don't, for that to happen, you actually don't need that to be gradient. If you have beta of, you know, 10 or 100 or something, you need the magnetic field to vary like r to the minus 2, for instance, to get to reverse migration.
So you've made some generalizations, which I'm not following. So earlier in the talk, you said that the outer disk would be more important than the lunar disk.
Without magnetic field, that's right. Because that's the problem, is that it's no, that's the whole problem, that it's incredibly robust. The reason why without the magnetic field the outer disk dominates is because these resonances here are slightly closer to the planet than the inner Lindblad resonances. And that's always true in a Keplerian disk. Now you need to make a huge gradient in the surface density or in the temperature to change that picture. So if you take something which is reasonable, you really have to work very hard on your parameters to actually change that ordering. And that's why it's very difficult to reverse migration in a hydro disk. But here you have these extra resonances that dominate now. And you can make one more important than the other by playing with the gradient of the field in a way which is not crazy. So if you compute the torque now, I'm sorry, these plots are really bad. If you compute the torque, this is what you get if you have no magnetic field. This is the torque from the outer disk on the planet, and this is the torque from the inner disk on the planet. So you see here the effect of the Lindblad resonances, and then you have a torque that's more or less constant. Now, if you put a magnetic field in your calculations, you see the effect here of the resonances I've been talking about. You get a torque here, which is very important. And then, I'm sorry, you can't see much. But then it doesn't differ from what you have here.
Is the magnetic torque in addition to the co-rotation torque, or is it, have you split the co-rotation?
You no longer have a co-rotation torque here. You no longer have a co-rotation resonance. You've given some rigidity to your disk, so you can no longer have these free particles surfing the tidal wave.
So in the limit that B tends to zero, do the magnetic torques combine?
Exactly. Yeah, because these resonances merge into the co-rotation resonance. Having said that, here I haven't actually summed over the torque, point-like torque contribution. And I tend to think this approach is actually, it works for hydro disks, but I'm surprised it actually works, because the torques that you get here are not that localized around the magnetic resonances. They tend to be rather delocalized. And even if you look at actually the Lindblad torque in a hydro disk, it's not really point-like. I mean, you have some kind of extension around the resonances where the torque is exerted. So now if you plot the torque here, so this is the total torque on the disk as a function of the, if you do a Fourier decomposition of your tidal potential, you get all these different values. So here, these squares here, open squares, are what you get without a magnetic field. So you get a positive contribution. This is a positive torque on the disk. So that's a negative torque on the planet that's migrating inward. Now, if you do the same calculation with a magnetic field by varying the gradient of the magnetic field, so if beta here increases outward, it means that the magnetic field decreases outward, then you get a negative torque. So the planet is migrating outward if the magnetic field is decreasing outward. So Sébastien Froment has done some numerical simulations of this process, because all I've talked about previously was linear. And so here we are still in the regime where it's more or less linear, because it's a small mass planet. It's five Earth masses. And here that's for beta parameter, which is actually 2. So these are the simulations that Sébastien has produced. The planet is here. You see these wakes as before, but you see now on both parts of the planet's orbit these two resonances. And here you have a zoom on the location of the planet. So this is the azimuthal angle. This is the radius. So the planet is here. And this is the surface density here, and this is the magnetic field here. And you see clearly on both sides of the planet these resonances. They are rather large here because Sébastien has put some viscosity in the code to dump the waves, actually. Otherwise, it was a bit messy. Well, these calculations are incredibly difficult to perform, because the location of these resonances is a fraction of the thickness of the disk. The separation between these resonances here is only a fraction of h. So you need a huge resolution near the planet. Sorry?
To the MHDB simulation where you could initially draw the field.
And so Sébastien has designed a logarithmic grid, actually, to look at this problem, where you have a very good resolution around the planet, and then it's coarser, further away from the planet.
But if it depends on the details of the behavior of the fluid, it scales less than the scale. Then, if you're thinking about your linear theory is being done by averaging over regions larger than the scale height or order of scale height, you're in trouble. Right? Your model, am I thinking of?
But look, I think, I mean, if I understand your question, the fact that you do 2D, despite of the fact that the resonances are within H from the planet, is that your concern?
No, I'm concerned that the magnetic field is unstable.
But I completely agree. I mean, you keep asking about it, and I keep telling you I completely agree. I mean, it may not exist in a turbulent disk. I'm not saying it's going to work in a turbulent disk. I completely agree with you. You might require a strong field which is not MRI unstable for that to be relevant, if it's relevant at all. I'm not claiming anything more than what I've done. I'm just telling you, if you put a field which is not unstable in your disk, this is what you get. Now, is that relevant? I don't know.
How do you know it doesn't work better? Maybe if you have a turbulent field, you have more resonance. I mean, I thought the key to this was just that you increase the response to the disk with additional resonance.
Yeah, but you need to be able to establish your resonances. So, probably that if you have a turbulent disk, I mean, you may not have the time to actually establish the resonances for the tidal response to be efficient.
Sort of sensitive.
Yeah. Structure. Yeah. No, you may be in trouble. I mean,
obviously on a certain storm we didn't have for like encouragement for the first time, but even since this station is in top constructed, you still have enhanced responses. You don't have exactly.
Maybe the best way to view this is that this is sort of an artificially simple system which can serve as a benchmark. And then in the turbulent calculation, you can go back and see whether there's any evidence.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about the simulations which have been done in the turbulent disk, but they don't resolve this.
An artificial construct.
I've never claimed more than what I've done here. You know, so I'm not saying, again, it's relevant in a disk where the field is unstable. But I still think that in the inner part, if you have a field which is strong enough to be stable, like if you get close enough to the star, which has a dipole field, then that may become relevant, and that may explain why, for instance, you pile up planets at 4 days. You know, it may just be that, but it may not even be that. I don't know. I'm not claiming more than what I'm presenting here. So, but again, I mean, I didn't realize that that could be a problem in a turbo-rounded because that was a mod that wasn't stable. The thing that gives me a little bit of hope, again, is that the mods that are relevant here are low-end mods. Basically, I mean, between 0 and 5 in this calculation.
But the issue is not so much that this particular mode is unstable, it's that the entire disk is unstable.
I'm going to show you what you, I mean, you know what you get if you put a planet in a turbulent disk. But, basically you don't get anything. I'll show that.
That relates to Alan's question.
No, but they haven't resolved this scale. You can't say anything about that process in the simulations that have been done because those scales haven't been resolved. I mean, again, Sebastian has spent lots of time trying to get these simulations to work because it's very difficult to resolve the scales that are of interest here. So here again, sorry for the axis, you can't see anything, but this is the torque versus time. And this is the semi-major axis now of the planet versus time. So these simulations have been done by Richard Nelson, who actually evolved the planet through the disk, where you have a stable magnetic field with beta is 2. What you see, if you have no magnetic field, this is the torque you get. That's the torque on the planet. It's negative, the planet is losing angular momentum. If now you put a constant magnetic field in your disk, a uniform magnetic field through your disk, you get a torque which is more or less the same. If you put a magnetic field that decreases with radius, with r to the minus 1 power law or r to the minus 2 power law, you do reverse migration. You get almost no migration with r to the minus 1 power law. You do get outer migration with r to the minus 2. In the analytical calculation, I find that you actually you don't reverse migration for r to the minus 1. And that agrees with this plot here, where you see that this is a semi-major axis. So you have inward migration for uniform field. You still have inward migration, but very slow for field decreasing like r to the minus 1. And you have outward migration for field decreasing like r to the minus 2. So that agrees basically with what you can predict from the analytical calculation. So now to try to make some claims about that. If these resonances still exist in a turbulent disk, which may not be the case, then you would just get, from this process, you would get a diffusive migration. Because, if you have a turbulent flow, the gradient of the magnetic field is going to be changing on small scales. And at some point, it's going to be decreasing outward. Some other points, it's going to be increasing outward. So the planet is just going to meet different gradients and is going to be pushed outward and inward kind of randomly. So you would predict just a diffusive migration in that case in the turbulent disk. So that just wouldn't give you any net migration in that case. But again, you need the resonances to still exist in that case, and that may not be the case. So another thing which may be interesting is that if you actually have a disk in which you have a dead zone, so you have a magnetic field in the inner part, and you have no magnetic field in some region of your disk, then when you have no magnetic field, you'll get inward migration in the usual way. But when the planet is going to meet the border, the location where you have a magnetic field, it's going to be pushed outward. So it's going to stop at the boundary between the magnetized and the non-magnetized region. But again, I mean, that's just claim from just based on what I presented before. That hasn't been checked, but that could be one of the consequences of this process. So now let me tell you briefly about calculations that have been done that I haven't done myself, but that have been done for planets in a turbulent disk. These are a calculation by Richard Nelson and John Paparoizou. They put a 10 Earth masses planet in a disk in which you have the MRI going on. What you have here is in blue, you have the torque exerted on the planet by the inner disk. In green here, you have the torque exerted by the outer disk, and in red, you have the total torque. What you see here is that there is no net migration. You have a random walk of the planet through the turbulent disk. And the reason is actually simple to understand. It's just because the disk is completely dominated by the fluctuations of the surface density. So you have blobs pushing you in and pushing you out. And you see that if you... This has been run for 20 orbits here at the location of the planet. But I think they've been running for longer than that now, haven't they?
Yeah, this is running.
But what I mean is the time scale come from a parameter of the turbulence that's put in by hand, or is the time scale for those fluctuations a natural outcome
of the turbulence?
Of the general parameters of the system, not connected.
I think it's connected to the turbulence. I mean, it's connected to a. Yeah, it's connected to the fluctuations of the disk.
And the turbulence is put in by hand.
No, the MRI, right. It's generated itself consistently.
Or the MRI is
magnetic. Yeah.
It's magnetic with turbulence. This is MRI on the
So that's basically orbital time scale.
More rapid than that?
Yeah. The fluctuations, I mean, this is orbital time scale. This is 15 orbital time scale. So the fluctuations are on a much shorter time scale. They've basically, what they've done is that they've taken a disk which is unstable, they've waited until the turbulence was established, and then they've put the planet. So this is what you get. I mean, again, you can understand why that happens. It's just that the fluctuations dominate the tidal perturbation from the planet.
Do you have a sense of what, if this has stayed lambda, what the magnitude of the torque would be?
It would be around here. It would be around here, 10 to the minus 5, I think, in this unit. Well, it clearly doesn't work here. That's right.
Not. I mean, are you sure that's not
advocating? They've been wondering whether you'd get some systematic effects out of these. It doesn't. It hasn't been run for long enough. But I think what you get here, intuitively, I think you can understand why you get no migration in a turbulent disk. But it hasn't been run long enough for systematic behavior to be. Yeah, even though for type 1 migration, it doesn't matter whether you have viscosity or not. If it's completely laminar, it still works. It's just a matter of transferring angular momentum to the disk.
Right, but I'm just trying to understand the extent to which turbulence doesn't act like viscosity.
It doesn't at all in this picture. What matters here is the fluctuation. It's just that you have blobs. I mean, you understand that what matters here is the amount of mass you have in the neighborhood of the planet to dump angular momentum. So if you have, because interaction is going on at the location of the Lindblad resonances, if you put lots of mass at these locations, that's going to help. Now, if you deplete the outer Lindblad resonances, in a sense that's coming back to your question, can you do something with sigma to change the direction of migration? I was saying you really have to push it hard, which is true in a smooth disk. But here you have these blobs that completely dominate the tidal perturbation from the planet. So with these fluctuations, you can change.
Also, I mean, just to come back, you say you have to work really hard or put in some really outlandish density gradients. But it seems to me that if you like quasi-linear evolution, I could conceive that the outer Lindblad resonance, say, would be depopulated before the NLR, and then it would be clean. It would be cleaned away, and then you would have a huge density.
Yeah, but you move. Your Lindblad resonances are never the same.
What?
Yeah, you have saturation at co-rotation, but not at the Lindblad.
Yeah.
But
you never get it at
the Lindblad resonances.
Cleaning out is not the same thing as saturation.
And you sweep through the disk. I mean, the Lindblad resonances are moving with the planet, so it's never at the same location in the disk.
So they're like
hands of picnic, they just follow you around. Yeah. Okay. So I think somewhat related to Alan's question is if the laminar flow, the torque is on rho minus.
I think of that because in Sebastian's simulation that was a unit cell, but here actually I don't know.
I guess
probably the same.
The fluctuation actually, it looks like here the fluctuation is close to sort of about zero.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so is there real? So
is it true that the fluctuation, like, it's not about the mean that you would have gotten?
No, here what you have, maybe I haven't made that clear, this is a cumulative torque. That's not that every single time, it's actually cumulative torque. So, you know, you move outward here, inward here, and, you know, you just have some kind of a random walk through the disk.
Is there a simple explanation for this? Because I'm confused. First, we discussed the migration in a disk of planetesimals. And there you show that the net effect is migration in. Then we had a cases,
yes,
and the same happened. So here, this should be somewhere in between, right? You have this fluctuating regions, and yet you don't have migration. So, you know, I'm positive.
Well, I mean, I think here the real reason is just that the fluctuations dominate over the perturbation by the planet. The planet has a low mass. Now, if you put a large mass planet, of course, you are going to recover the. I'll come back to that in a minute. But here, that's a planet which is low mass enough that the perturbation it induces is completely dominated by the turbulence. You see it, you kind of see it in these. In these pictures here, this is a planet, this is a zoom, this is a radius, and this is the azimuth. This is a planet. You can still see the wakes, you know, that you have in a hydro disk, but you can see the mess around. I mean,
it's like ground in motion.
It is, exactly, yeah. Yeah, it's diffusive, yeah. And here it's what you have, this is a global view. You still see these density waves propagating, but nonetheless, it's dominated by the fluctuations.
The way that you might want to think of it is that the time scale for system to do whatever it wants to do may be vastly extended, perhaps even longer than the lifetime of the system in principle. But I think your point is well taken, and that is that a minimum energy state of a system where you minimize the energy and conserve the angular momentum, it's all the mass on the inside and all the angular momentum on the outside. And if you have a system which is spontaneously unstable and turbulent, it's hard to believe that really what it wants to do is to send matter out. That really is not the minimum energy state. So ultimately, it may well be the case that the planet is going to wind up going in. That would be my personal guess. The details of how that happens are complicated, and it may take, you know, a much, much longer time for that thing to occur.
No, they certainly say that in their paper. They haven't run it for long enough to be able to get any systematic, you know, in the evolution of that system. So now I'm just going to, this is my last slide now. This is now talking about a giant planet in a turbulent disk. So these simulations, this is a plot from Nelson and Papaworth 2003, but Steve and John Hawley and what's his first name, Winters? Wayne Winters, have done similar calculations. So here you put a Jupiter mass planet in a turbulent disk. So the same thing as before, except that now the planet is much more massive. So what you observe is because now the perturbation from the planet is much larger than, you know, the fluctuations from the turbulence, you do still get a gap. What you have here is a surface density versus radius. So at the location of the planet, you get a gap. So let me explain you what I've put here. This is what you would get if you had a disk with no viscosity, laminar disk, no turbulence, no viscosity. You have a gap, which is, so this is material co-rotating with the planet, and here you have the gap. So you have a very clean, deep gap. Now, if you take an alpha disk, a viscous disk, with an alpha parameter of 5 × 10⁻³, this is the gap you get. So this is what people had been doing, just using a hydro code with an Navier-Stokes equation. Now, if you take a turbulent simulation and put the planet in your disk, so no Navier-Stokes, self-consistent turbulence coming from the MRI, that gives you an alpha. You can measure, you can derive some viscous evolution timescale for this run and see that it's equivalent to having an alpha of 5 × 10⁻³. So that's why you also run this calculation to compare it with this turbulent calculation. So this is the gap that you get. And it's interesting to see that you do have a difference in how clean the gap is depending on whether you run a Navier-Stokes thing or a turbulent disk. So you can see here that even though for the global evolution of your system, you can still model your disk as an alpha disk, because the evolution time scale is kind of the same. If you look at the detail of the gap, it's actually changing, depending on whether you have a turbulent disk or an alpha prescription. And you can see that here, your turbulence is not acting as an alpha at the edges of the gap. You have actually this big fluctuation of the radial velocity at the edges of the gap, which makes it actually easier to have a cleaner gap. If you have just a viscous thing, it's pushing the edges of the gap in, balancing the tidal torque, and it's more difficult to get a clean torque in that case. So this is all I'm going to say about all these things. So I just wanted to concentrate on what has been done, planet migration in the magnetism. So in the regime where you are turbulent or where you are not turbulent. Thank you.
If I just can come back to this, I guess maybe the way to say it is that these turbulent regions simply do not live long enough to get into resonance with the planet, and that's why way through the day before you establish resonance, and that's why you get no.
If these resonances, these magnetic resonances I was talking about earlier on, were to exist, they may not exist in a turbulent disk, but if they were to exist, they wouldn't have seen them here because the resolution they have is not good enough. And these resolutions, these resonances are very, very close to the planet, and these runs are not don't have a resolution which is good enough to see that. So, I mean, that's one of the of the Lindblad resonances. So the Lindblad resonances, I mean, you can always define a Lindblad resonance, it's just that it's not effective in that case. Because the amount of mass you have there is just fluctuating.
So in the case of the planet, small mass, let's say 10 Earth masses, in the turbulent disk, if we have not just a very smooth type 1 migration, but we have this random walk going on. So it could be also the possibility that the migration time in this case will be longer, and then it will just sort of go into direction that and this too short time for migration can be at least, I mean, a bit.
Yeah. I think that's the point that Elaine was making, that you may have some systematic effect if you run this simulation for long enough, but, you know, that hasn't been done.
Yeah, John suggested something.
Yeah.
So if you're moving these planetesimals back and forth in the disk, doesn't that screw up the abundance, sort of well-defined radial abundance gradients in the solar system for asteroids, say? And there are well-defined differences in the asteroid composition as a function of center major axis.
But that's something which is very difficult to explain in any case if you take migration into account. I would think it's easier to explain if you have turbulence halting migration, because then you don't migrate for large scales. I mean, you can, you know, it's random, you go out, in and out. So you kind of stay at the same place. In a sense, it's easier if you have turbulence to keep the core where you are. But within the context of migrating cores, it's very difficult to explain these gradients. I mean, it's a prime anyway. I would think that turbulence actually makes it easier. But of course, turbulence would act only on low-mass cores. Once you form something like a Jupiter-mass planet, it doesn't act anymore. So you can still have migration of large-mass planets if you have enough mass around.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.